everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to talk about how eating almonds can improve vascular health. A study from King's College London, published in the peer-reviewed journal American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, has to do with improving endothelial function and lowering the bad LDL cholesterol levels. Well, we'll get into that and a lot more on health and healing. But the majority of our program today will be devoted to part four of understanding who is Bill Gates. Now, there's several ways to understand Mr. Gates. One is by having a discussion, open and honest discussion, with the person who was his partner, who helped found Microsoft all those years ago, but didn't have a lot of good things to say about him. So we'll be hearing Paul Allen, the co-creator of Microsoft, talk about what it was like to be around Bill Gates. Now, there's going to be three things specifically that he's going to say about Bill Gates and his behavior and how his brain works that is crucial for today, because there is no one on the planet more powerful in directing the COVID effort than Bill Gates. And you will hear him in his own words say today that he wants to see every person on the planet vaccinated. He doesn't believe that we should be opening our society up until they're all vaccinated. But wouldn't you first have to test people to see whether or not they had the COVID virus? There's a lot of contradictions. There's a lot of misinformation. We're going to share some of that with you today, as we have Dr. Pam Popper, who has a very impressive background. She's going to give us some insight about why she's concerned about the information we're getting, how unreliable it is, how, in fact, not just unreliable, how fraudulent it is. So you see, if we say we have a pandemic and everybody must stay at home and we must have 40 million Americans unemployed as a consequence, and 40% of businesses, small businesses, won't be able to reopen, they're bankrupt, and 11%, according to Forbes or Bloomberg, that opens will go broke within 3 months, we're looking at the largest permanent amount of unemployed in American history, and there's not going to be jobs readily available. So all this because fraudulent information? Yeah. It doesn't mean that the virus is fraudulent. The virus is real, and for certain people with comorbidities can be deadly. But what are your chances of actually dying? Well, the CDC gave us brand new figures today on the COVID virus. Even new information came today from The Guardian, from a peer-reviewed journal, the New England Medical Journal. How long does the COVID virus last on surfaces? Well, if you put alcohol or you put hydrogen peroxide or bleach, instantly killed, gone. But let's say you don't do anything, it can last anywhere up to about 72 hours. So, okay, but less, 6 hours, if it's on plastic. And even less, it's on copper. But what about the seriousness? How many people are going to die? This is just today, and it says the CDC confirms remarkably low coronavirus death rate. Where is the media? Question mark. Quote, this is from Daniel Horowitz. Most people are more likely to wind up 6 feet under because of almost anything else under the sun other than the COVID-19. The CDC just came out with a report that should be earth-shattering to the narrative of the political class, yet it will go into the thick pile of vital data and information about the virus that is not getting out to the public. For the first time, the CDC has attempted to offer a real estimate of the overall death rate for COVID-19. And under its most likely scenario, the number is 0.26%. Official estimate of 0.4% fatality rate among those who are symptomatic, and projected 35% rate of asymptomatic cases among those infected, which drops the overall infection fatality rate to just 0.26, which means that if you get the COVID virus, unless you have multiple comorbidities and you're old, you have a chance of dying 99.2%. You won't. there's a greater chance you'll die of the flu or pneumonia. So now that many different experts are looking honestly at the facts, we've been lied to about everything, and it's time that we stop this. And even Stanford University researchers pegged it a month ago. They were more accurate. So that's part of what we're going to talk about today, but these are just the latest statistics. So this is why we shouldn't be using this information they've given us without challenging it. For example, the National Institutes of Health director, quote, and by the way, the National Institutes of Health oversees all of these agencies, quote, no way of knowing if coronavirus escaped from the Wuhan lab. No way of knowing. But then we find out that the national intelligence agencies in the United States found the phone calls being made from one part of the lab that was doing research in this area, and they stopped all phone calls, which means that lab was shut down, that division, before there was any announcement that there was a virus. So put these pieces together. We know that the lab had no phone calls going in or out. That means that nobody was there, and this is prior to any official announcement, and yet we have a great deal of evidence that research is being done, including being paid for by the United States through Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease on studying and making even more deadly the bat coronavirus. Now, they can say it wasn't to be weaponized. It was just to try to make a vaccine, but this is what's being hidden from us. Now the facts are coming out. So I'm just giving you the latest information and why it's important. Oh, and by the way, if you think because you have the virus and no symptoms, you're immune, think again. Today, Smithsonian Magazine, a Catherine Wu, quote, some immune responses may be enough to make a person impervious to reinfection, but scientists don't know yet how the human body reacts to this virus, and because it's, quote, so complicated. So can we say that a person who is infected but no symptoms, the body has cleared it, now they're safe? No, we cannot. There is no actual clinical studies to prove this, and what they've been using are false mathematical models. So once again, we're making policy without having the evidence to do it intelligently. And how's this impacting people? Well, here's today's latest results. This is from The Guardian. Quote, U.S. job losses pass 40 million as coronavirus crisis sees claims rise 2.1 in a week. The rate of new unemployment claims has continued. And so even though it's lower, it's still the most unemployed people we've ever had in American history, including during the Great Depression. Here's the bad news. In 2001, with the dot-com bubble, people got back to work. In 2007, 2008, with the subprime bubble crashing and lots of people lost their jobs, people found other jobs and unemployment increased. This one, those jobs are gone. Whole areas of our society are simply wiped clean. They can't get the loans to get back in business. They wouldn't be able to repay the outstanding loans they already had. Foreclosures are going to go through the roof. Bankruptcies are going to be the most in world history. And so that's what this complete mess of total incompetence at every level has created. Now, I'm going to give you the latest on health and healing. Then we're going to go into some of this. And why you're going to know more about Bill Gates than you've ever known in your life is because you're going to see the real Bill Gates and what his actual motives are, how he's been able to buy loyalty and buy people in scientific communities, governmental agencies, World Health Organizations. He is quite simply the most powerful person in the world. And the media fawns over him. Well, you're going to hear a more honest report than that. And also, we have a Christine Grady who has a segment where we're going to play a little clip connecting Bill Gates. Oh, well, Anthony Fauci's not associated with the Gates Foundation. Not directly, but on all the other foundations, he sure is. He's a member, and she found the evidence by getting their actual corporate resolutions and who's there. And there is Anthony Fauci right beside what was funded by Bill Gates. So they're working at the hip together. So Anthony Fauci, in my opinion, my personal opinion, should be trusted on nothing. Nothing at all. I wouldn't believe a single thing that this man said about anything. Now, this is at the same time that they're trying to censor anyone who has an opinion or a facts that would challenge the existing story on the promotion of a vaccine, or any vaccine for that matter, or anything on alternative health. They're even building up your immune system naturally, which they should be advocating to everyone. Every nursing home center in the world should be giving a whole new protocol. Now, because I've worked with probably more seniors than any other planet on person in America as far as their health, I would be happy to donate my time with any legitimate health professionals, nursing homes, assisted living centers, medical doctors, nurses, to give you protocols that keep your patients alive and keep their immune system strong, and so therefore they would have better quality of life and probably a longer life. But that's not what they want. They want a drug and they want a vaccine, because that's where the money is. So anything that would challenge that is being thrown off Facebook, Google, Twitter, and of course Wikipedia. More on that tomorrow, because we're now starting a campaign to get all other platforms to be eliminated as far as their indemnification so they could be sued. So let's go back to the beginning here. Researchers led by Dr. Hall, the head of the nutrition sciences at King's College London, published a very important article. And what he's saying is very simple. It makes common sense. Replace your popular snacks like pretzels and potato chips and french fries with almonds. Why? Because a handful of almonds can improve your endothelial function, which is an indicator of vascular health, and it helps lower the bad LDL cholesterol. And that's what this study showed. A 6 weeks randomized controlled parallel arm trial, those that had the almonds had a 32% reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. Well, consider how many people throughout the world die of cardiovascular disease. This is a big deal. Oh, and by the way, 1.5 million people die in car accidents every year. So keep in mind that every minute someone's dying. Well north of 1 million people die in the United States each year. So suddenly everybody's, you know, they're dying of COVID. You know, if there was a plane crash, all the victims be, well, they all died of COVID. Don't trust a single statistic you hear from the CDC. It is an utterly corrupt organization. They're as corrupt as any La Costa Nostra operation, except far more deadly. In any case, have your almonds. Do something good for yourself. From the National Institute of Neuroscience, which is in Japan, and they published in the peer-reviewed journal Brain, arginine, A-R-G-I-N-I-N-E, can help if you have neurodegenerative diseases. That means any neurodegenerative diseases. A bulbar muscular atrophy caused by mutations in the genes that are important for the proper function of neurons. The mutations trigger abnormal aggregation of what is called poly-Q proteins, which leads to neuronal toxicity and neurodegeneration. There's where this comes in. So if you have any kind of brain problem, think of arginine, the amino acid. Also from Catholic University of Korea, that's South Korea, acetyl L-carnitine can boost memory in Alzheimer's patients. That's good news. And by the way, acetyl L-carnitine can be found in the liver and the brain and helps produce energy to sustain your heart and your brain function. It also is good for supporting muscle movement and other processes. So it's just good and can also help mitochondrial energy generation in the brain. So if you want a healthier brain and help reduce the severity of depressive symptoms and depression, then simply acetyl L-carnitine. There's a lot of studies, University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. They also found this. So, good for them. University of North Carolina, vitamin D in older individuals, and viral resistance and slowing progression of Parkinson's disease. So according to this study out of the University of North Carolina School of Medicine at Chapel Hill, they're talking about the body and building up some immune system. Vitamin D is right there, especially if you're older. But there are a lot of studies on vitamin D, generally 2,000 to 5,000 units a day. And for those who keep saying and have historically, you know, wear the stupid mustaches, you know, that they had, those idiot celebrities who will do anything for a buck except look at the science. Here's the latest from North American Menopause Society. Dairy consumption ineffective in preventing age-related bone loss or fractures. And this is a study of women's health across the nation, what's called SWAN, that showed during menopause transition when bone loss is accelerated, there's no benefit to remineralization using dairy. Interesting, because we just finished our anti-aging study and we remineralized everyone's bone, including a woman who was not supposed to do the study because her doctor said at 94, she had very advanced osteoporosis. We almost doubled the percentage of her bone in the study. And finally, from Emory University, Staphylococcus aureus, or also is called MRSA, it's deadly, kills tens of thousands in the United States and across the world, many more. But there is a compound in pepper tree berries that can disarm MRSA. That's correct. Specific compounds from the Brazilian pepper tree pack a punch against the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. So just want to give you a heads up. It's demonstrated that the what are called triterpenoids, it's an acid in the red berries of the plant, disarm dangerous staph bacteria by blocking its ability to produce toxins. So just want to give you things that can save people's lives. Oh, and by the way, University of Miami, being overweight later in life, meaning over the age of 40, leads to a faster brain aging. So your weight does impact negatively your brain when you're overweight. That's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to go to a short clip. It's not the whole 60 Minutes interview with Leslie Stahl, but it's dealing with someone who knew Bill Gates better than anyone else, a childhood buddy. But the person that actually went in and sold the whole method by showing that it worked was Paul Allen. There are three things you're going to hear about Bill Gates. Do you really think that Bill Gates has changed who he is as a person? And imagine if he did this to his own partner, what you're about to hear. What the hell do you think that this guy could do running the world? What he is doing now. There's no one more powerful. And in my opinion, the media has been supplicants to him, and all the professors and the scientists, public officials, once you accept money from someone and you keep getting it, it makes it very difficult to challenge them. Back in a moment.
Describe Bill Gates in very harsh terms. You describe him as being quite abusive. I mean, it's not a pretty picture.
And I felt like when I wrote it, I should just tell it like it happened in an unvarnished way, warts and all.
You know, here he is doing such great work. He's almost a saint now. And it seems like an odd time to write an unflattering portrait of him.
The timing had nothing to do with the many wonderful things that Bill has done. But the timing was because I wanted to see if I could do it hopefully be alive to see it published.
No wonder he was concerned. When he started the book in 2009, he had stage 4 lymphoma. The book goes back to the beginning. This is a picture of Allen when he was 15 and met a boy at his private school in Seattle, 2 years his junior, named Bill Gates.
There's the machine room. It's in the machine room in there. Well, I think the UW.
This video shows the two buddies revisiting an old computer lab where they used to feed their obsession with programming.
That you lift me into one of those huge garbage bins.
Bill and I would actually dive in the dumpsters to try to find listings of the secret inner code of the operating system.
You're
and
kidding.
Try to figure out how it worked. That's how passionate we were.
So now we're going to go from there. Before we go to the Corbett Report, I want you to hear Dr. Pam Popper. She's going to tell you why she's concerned. And by the way, just a little background. Dr. Popper is she's executive director of the Wellness Forum. She serves on the Physician Steering Committee and the President's Board for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, Washington, D.C. She was also part of Dr. T. Colin Campbell's teaching team at Cornell University. And she's well known in the field. And if you saw the documentary, very well done documentary, Forks Over Knives, she played a major role in that as well. Here's what she has to say about why she doesn't trust any of the figures that we've been given.
In Illinois, as it turns out, the numbers used to justify the lockdown are manipulated as per instructions issued by the CDC. On April 20th, 2020, the Illinois Department of Health Director, Dr. Ngozi Ezike, explained how her department decides whether or not a death is due to COVID-19. She said that anyone who dies and has tested positive is categorized as a COVID death. So you get hit by a bus, the trauma kills you, but you're COVID-19 positive. Death certificate says death by COVID. Okay, we call that misrepresentation where I come from. I'm going to read to you verbatim what she said. Quote, if you were in hospice and had already been given a few weeks to live, and then you were also found to have COVID, that would be counted as a COVID death. It means technically, even if you died of a clear alternative cause, but you had COVID at the same time, it's still listed as a COVID death. So everyone who's listed as a COVID death doesn't mean that was the cause of the death, but they had COVID at the time of the death. So I find that an interesting quote. Those were her words directly. You can go online and read this. So she basically said, whether or not they died of COVID, we're going to count it as a COVID death. So they could have died of something else, but we still put it on the death certificate because in the world of public health in Illinois, telling the truth is obviously not part of the culture there. Even while using falsified death certificates, state health officials acknowledged on April 20th that the number of cases and deaths is decreasing, yet today in late May, the state remains locked down by the emperor of Illinois, Jay Pritzker. I have some more to say about him later in the week. Colorado State Representative Mark Baisley has asked for a formal investigation into Jill Ryan, executive director of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, with the potential for criminal charges to be brought. According to Baisley, Ryan has falsely altered death certificates. This is even one step further than the nitwit in Illinois. Baisley provided a letter from the Summer and Glen Senior Care Facility, which was sent to its staff, residents, and families of residents, stating that the Colorado Public Health Department had changed the cause of death recorded by the attending physicians in 7 cases to reflect COVID-19 instead of the actual cause of death. In other words, in this case, what happened is the Department of Health overrode and changed it once a physician had signed off on it. The Montezuma County Coroner told the same news station that reported this, that the state overruled the cause of death for a person in his jurisdiction too. The person died of alcohol poisoning, but it was changed to COVID-19. So I guess the deal is that in order to make the numbers sound terrible, we do whatever we have to do, including forgery, falsification, actually changing the thing on the death certificate, the entry. It's pretty incredible. Eventually, the Colorado Department of Health actually acknowledged that the numbers had been inflated by people who had the virus but died of other causes and by falsified death certificates and adjusted the numbers down from 1,150 deaths to 878. Now, remember Dr. Deborah Birx, who looked into the camera and told everybody to follow the CDC's directions and falsify death certificates? Yeah, her. She's changed her mind about that. Just a few weeks ago, during one of the White House press briefings, she directly said, and there was a fuss about it. I mean, we got calls from doctors who said, I have to do this or lose my job, but I resent being told that I have to lie in order to keep my job. So now she's saying the opposite. She's asked the CDC to exclude from the death count people who had the virus but died of something else, and also to remove those who were presumed to have the virus but did not have confirmed lab results. Birx and other health officials now are taking issue with the CDC's system, claiming that the number of cases and mortality may be inflated by as much as 25%. She said, quote, there is nothing from the CDC that I can trust. Gosh, she used to love these people. She used to lie for these people. Not surprisingly, the CDC has refused.
Now, Understand, here's four problems. One, you did not have a worldwide antibody accurate test that could determine if a person actually had the coronavirus. Two, the people who were dying at the highest rates were those in hospice care, because you go into hospice to die. It might take an hour, might take a week. It generally doesn't take more than a month. All those were considered COVID. Nursing homes didn't have COVID deaths until infected attendees, family members brought them in, or most importantly, COVID patients were sent into those. Those people who were responsible for that then turned around and gave indemnification at the nursing homes, so you can't sue the nursing home. That's a political move. And by the way, we found out that those also, the nursing homes, were giving large contributions to the different governors, including Governor Cuomo. Quote, this is from The Guardian. Andrew Cuomo gave immunity to nursing home execs after big campaign donations. Critics say data proves New York's liability shield is linked to higher nursing home deaths rates during the pandemic. Also today, it was discovered that a lot of deaths had been changed, and meaning that they were not accurately counting the actual number of people who died in nursing homes. So it could be anywhere from 35 to 50%. So if 50% of the people dying were dying in nursing homes and they were there to die already, you cannot with any legitimacy say that that represents a general threat to the general population. And if for those that it does represent a threat to, you can have much better way of handling those people than intubation, which killed almost 100% of the people in one study, for example. So that was mishandled. Again, the numbers were falsified. Before this woman backtracked and said, don't count everything, because what if a person hasn't even been tested? Because people that weren't even tested for the COVID virus were called COVID deaths. And then the autopsy reports, funeral homes were saying every person that dies and everybody that comes in, even out of a car wreck, is COVID. So we have, instead of a 99.3% chance of living and only a small percentage of dying, you better reduce that by at least 50%. That would mean that it's less deadly than a flu. So we've been lied to at every point of this. Now we're going to take you directly into the Bill and Melinda Gates. By the way, just last week, what do you think of this? This is from Business Insider Theron Mohammed. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust invested in Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Alibaba, and Twitter in the last quarter. $450 million in total. Well, that gives you a lot of control over what is now going to be excluded as fake news, right? Wow, how corrupt is this entire scenario? Now let's give you the Corbett Report for the last segment of our look, inside look at Bill Gates.
Computer whiz kid, talented software developer, shrewd businessman, benevolent philanthropist, global health expert. There can be no doubt that Bill Gates has worn many hats on his remarkable journey from his early life as the privileged son of a Seattle-area power couple to his current status as one of the richest and most influential people on the planet. But as we have seen in our exploration of Gates' rise as unelected global health czar and population control advocate, the question of who Bill Gates really is no mere philosophical pursuit. Given that we are currently living through a crisis that has been predicted by Bill Gates, which is triggering a response from the global health organizations that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has bankrolled, and driving us toward a vaccination and biometric ID solution which Bill Gates has been working on for years, the answer to the question, who is Bill Gates, is quickly becoming one of the most important questions of our lives. That answer will not only tell us about the world that we are living in, but about the one that we are being thrust into, and how we can avoid it. Today we will attempt to answer that question as we examine the motives, the ideology, and the connections of this man who has been so instrumental in shaping the post-coronavirus world. Meet Bill Gates. You're tuned into the Corbett Report. So who is Bill Gates? Some argue that he's a genius who leveraged his natural computer savvy into a billion-dollar fortune.
You're called a genius, and I will... Well, no, I don't think that embarrassed you at all. They call you a genius. Part of your genius is that you are a computer whiz. And the other is that you did have the business acumen to turn it into a working company. Are you a business genius, too?
Well, I wouldn't say genius.
Others insist that he is a visionary who has changed our lives with his foresight and bold imagination.
Bill had a vision, and I understand it went back even then, that computing would be ubiquitous. It would be part of all of our lives. And indeed, as you all know, he executed on that vision, and the world today has changed so dramatically, in large part due to the work that Bill has done throughout the years.
He has been hailed as a shrewd executive who built the Microsoft empire with his remarkable talent for business.
When the biographers and historians write the history of the 20th century, Bill Gates is going to go down as the best businessman of our century, and Microsoft is one of the greatest companies of the 20th century.
And he has been praised as a philanthropist who is selflessly devoting his wealth to improving the lives of people around the world.
Bill, even your harshest critic would have to admit that your philanthropy work is, you know, planet-shaking, incredible, and could be, if you make it, a second act so amazing that it would dwarf what you've actually done at Microsoft.
But, like anyone of his status, he has his detractors. In the 1990s, he was often portrayed as the greedy head of the evil Microsoft monopoly.
Bill Gates isn't content with his Windows system running just a few PCs. He wants it to run the world, spreading like a computer virus into our faxes, our phones, our TV sets, and yes, even our toasters.
But in the age of the coronavirus crisis, he is most often treated like some sort of epidemiologist or leading health researcher.
Back here with us once again to talk about this, as well as testing, treatments, and more, Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill, thanks so much for being back with us. It's been a little over a month since you were here, and at that time, you said the U.S. had not hit its peak. So at this point, do you think we have peaked, and where do you think we are right now in kind of the arc of the pandemic?
But in truth, none of these perspectives are accurate. Microsoft's big break famously came from a deal to provide software for IBM as they moved into the personal computer market. But the deal was not the result of Gates' technical genius or amazing business acumen. As has been quietly admitted by IBM executives in the years since, Microsoft was given their shot at the chance to work with Big Blue as a result of Gates' mother's relationship with IBM CEO John Opel.
You remember your partnership of IBM and Bill Gates? How did it break up?
I do remember very well, actually. Bill Gates, at the time, at the beginning of our relationship with him, was living on pizza and Pepsi-Cola in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And his mother happened to be on the United Way board with our chairman and asked our chairman to help him. And, you know, when the chairman comes in and tells you to go help this kid, 900 people get on the plane Monday morning, and they all go down to try to help Bill Gates. So I don't see Bill Gates as this great creative person. I see him as an opportunist. And in fact, in those days, there was a lot of sharing of software code. People gave it away. In Silicon Valley, they would share everything. He came in, and he tried to control everything and put a price on it.
Computer historians have long known how the basis for what became MS-DOS was not Bill Gates' brilliant imagination, but QDOS, a quick and dirty operating system that had been thrown together by Tim Patterson, a worker at Seattle Computer Products, as a placeholder until he could sell a proper operating system to his customers. And as even Gates himself admitted, the breakthrough graphical user interface that became the basis for Windows was ripped off from the researchers at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center.
As Bill would say after Apple unsuccessfully sued Microsoft for copyright infringement over Windows GUI, "Hey, Steve, just because you broke into Xerox's house before I did and took the TV doesn't mean I can't go in later and take the stereo."
And, As Gates also admits, it is not a spirit of selfless generosity that motivates his interest in vaccines and other lucrative health interventions.
I'd like to talk to you about your approach to vaccinations. You wrote something recently, and like you always do, you kind of looked at the problem from a scientific and business perspective on things. You've invested $10 billion in vaccinations over the last two decades, and you figured out the return on investment for that, and it kind of stunned me. Can you walk us through the math?
You know, we see a phenomenal track record. It's been $100 billion overall that the world's put in. Our foundation is a bit more than $10 billion. But we feel there's been over a 20-to-1 return. So if you just look at the economic benefits, that's a pretty strong number compared to anything else.
As we have seen, Gates's philanthropic investment scheme has paid off well, with his $50 billion net worth having ballooned to over $100 billion after his decade of altruism in the vaccine market. As critics of his foundation have repeatedly pointed out, the 9 million people who die every year of hunger would be best served by securing food supplies, running water, and other basic necessities, not costly medical interventions for rare diseases. But there is no return on investment to be made from that kind of charity. No, this is not about charity. It is about control. The population control grid that Gates has been quietly funding into existence for the past decade, a biometric identification system tied to a digital payments infrastructure that will be used to track, catalog, and control every movement, every transaction, and every interaction of every citizen, is just now coming into view. But the real question is, why is he doing this? What drives a man like Bill Gates, a man rich beyond the wildest dreams of avarice, to spend his time and invest his fortune in schemes to control the population? To find the answer to that question, we have to examine Gates's family background. Bill Gates, it should not be surprising to learn, was born into money. His great-grandfather, J.W. Maxwell, was the president of National City Bank in Seattle. His grandfather, Willard, was also a banker, and his grandmother, Adele, a prominent Seattle civic leader. Bill Gates' mother, Mary Maxwell Gates, was a scion of the Maxwell banking family and, by all accounts, as hard-driving as her forebears. She served as a director of several companies, including First Interstate Bancorp and KIRO-TV of Seattle. She served as a regent at the University of Washington, and she was appointed to the board of the United Way of America, where, as we have seen, she persuaded IBM CEO John Opel to help her son in his fledgling software development career. Bill's father, William H. Gates Sr., was a prominent Seattle-area lawyer. He co-founded a powerful law and lobbying firm, helped Howard Schultz in his bid to buy Starbucks, served on the boards of numerous companies and organizations, and, along the way, had a profound influence on his son's life and career.
My dad was large presence, both physically and in terms of his wisdom. He worked very hard, so he'd leave in the mornings, often before we had breakfast, and get home in time for dinner. You know, I always looked up to my dad in terms of how hard he worked. At the dinner table, my dad would go through various lawsuits and expect us to follow along. He had high expectations.
The young Bill Gates, technically William H. Gates III, although his card-playing family dubbed him Trey, learned much from his parents. From his mother's banking family, he inherited a nose for the dollar, as one childhood friend's father called it. From his hard-driving, legal-minded father, he learned the value of legalizing business arrangements. As a child, he even had a legal contract drawn up to grant him the use of his older sister's baseball mitt. These traits would not earn him many friends, but they served him well as he began to bring order to the anarchic software development community of the 1970s. At that time, software for the brand new personal computer market was the realm of computer hobbyists, people whose excitement about the microcomputer revolution and love of engineering and problem-solving led them to develop and share code freely with each other. But this was no good for the young Bill Gates, who, even before Microsoft was off the ground, was already dreaming of commoditizing this hobby and turning it into the basis of a business empire. In 1976, with the ink still wet on Microsoft's first contract with Micro Instrumentation and Telemetry Systems of Albuquerque, New Mexico, the then 21-year-old Gates wrote an open letter to hobbyists, excoriating the early computer enthusiasts who represented his main market for sharing Microsoft's code for Altair Basic. As the majority of hobbyists must be aware, most of you steal your software. Hardware must be paid for, but software is something to share. Who cares if the people who worked on it get paid? Is this fair? The royalty paid to us, the manual, the tape, and the overhead make it a break-even operation. One thing you do is prevent good software from being written. Who can afford to do professional work for nothing? What hobbyist can put 3 man-years into programming, finding all bugs, documenting his product, and distribute for free? The fact is, no one besides us has invested a lot of money in hobby software. We have written 6800 BASIC and are writing 8080 APL and 6800 APL, but there is very little incentive to make this software available to hobbyists. Most directly, the thing you do is theft. The letter was awkward and tone-deaf, as many people have described the young Bill Gates in his social interactions. It heaped vitriol on the very people who would be the customers of any future business, and tried to change an established culture of sharing software code merely by decree. Even Apple computers, which would go on to be one of the prime purveyors of walled garden systems that restrict users' ability to control their own computers, scored an easy marketing victory by responding to Gates' angry letter with a reminder that, yes, folks, Apple Basic is free. But the gauntlet was thrown down, and Gates would have his way. Although freeware and other forms of open-source software development still exist, the establishment of software code as legally protected intellectual property has led to the rise of billionaires like Gates. A nose for the dollar and a knowledge of how to use the legal system to get what you want were not the only things to emerge from Bill Gates' childhood, however. His parents also encouraged discussion about the family's charity work and the causes they held close to their heart. As Gates revealed to Bill Moyers in 2003, those causes included the population issue, which sparked a lifelong interest in reproductive health.
One issue that really grabbed me as urgent were issues related to population, reproductive health.
But did you come to reproductive issues as an intellectual?
When I was growing up, my parents were always involved in various volunteer things. My dad was head of Planned Parenthood, and it was very controversial to be involved with that.
Gates tips his hand when he equates issues related to population with reproductive health. The topic is particularly controversial because population control and reproductive health have been used for half a century as a euphemism for eugenics, the discredited pseudoscience that holds that certain families are fit to be leaders of society by virtue of their superior genes. As we saw in Why Big Oil Conquered the World, eugenics was a field named and codified by Francis Galton, cousin of Charles Darwin. Ostensibly concerned with heredity and what would later be known as genetics, the eugenicists believed that the rich and powerful were rich and powerful not because of luck or chance or happenstance, and certainly not from the deployment of cutthroat business tactics and underhanded dealings. No, the rich and powerful had attained their status because they came from better stock. Conversely, the poor were poor because of their defective germplasm. As transparent as it seems to us today that this ideology was a self-serving self-justification for the ruling class, it was quickly taken up as the great social crusade of the early 20th century. From Teddy Roosevelt to H.G. Wells to Julian Huxley to Winston Churchill, there was widespread support for the eugenicist notion that society must strive to make sure that the rich and well-born breed as much as possible, and the poor, infirm, and feeble-minded be prevented from having children. A common eugenicist argument was that the scarce resources of society should not be used to support the lower classes, as that only encouraged more of their kind. Instead, life-saving medical care and intervention should be rationed so that those resources can be best put to use elsewhere. So-called negative eugenicists even took things further, with some, like famed playwright George Bernard Shaw, calling for people to be called before a state-appointed board to justify their existence or be put to death.
But there are an extraordinary number of people whom I want to kill. Not in any unkind or personal spirit, but it must be evident to all of you, you must all know half a dozen people at least, who are no use in this world, who are more trouble than they are worth. And I think it would be a good thing to make everybody come before a properly appointed board, just as he might come before the income tax commissioners, and say every 5 years or every 7 years, just put him there and say, sir or madam, now will you be kind enough to justify your existence?
But in the post-World War II era, as the name of eugenics became tarred by association with the Nazi atrocities, the talk of death penalties and other harsh eugenicist notions was dropped from public conversation. Now, the quest to reduce the size of the poor population was spoken of as population control and reproductive health. Still, occasionally, these old negative eugenics ideas are revisited in moments of candor.
You're raising tuitions at the University of California as rapidly as they can, and so the access that used to be available to the middle class or whatever is just rapidly going away. That's a trade-off society is making because of very, very high medical costs and a lack of willingness to say, you know, is spending $1 million on that last 3 months of life for that patient, would it be better not to lay off?
For those of you who are listening, we must say goodbye to our WBAI, a sister station at this moment, because they have to use the last 5 minutes of the program. But we're going to continue playing this to finish this clip. Another 6 minutes, go to prn.fm, prn.fm. So for BAI, we'll see you tomorrow. For everyone else, go to prn.fm. Let's continue.
Those 10 teachers and to make that trade-off in medical costs. But that's called the death panel, and you're not supposed to have that discussion.
It is worth questioning why this man, who openly muses about death panels and the trade-offs of providing health care to the elderly, is to be taken completely at face value in his attempts to slow population growth in the third world, or to handle a coronavirus health crisis that primarily affects the elderly. That the Gates agenda is being driven by a eugenicist ideology is suggested by multiple lines of evidence, both historical and current. As we have also seen in Why Big Oil Conquered the World, the Rockefeller family was instrumental in funding and promoting eugenics, both in America and overseas. The Rockefellers helped fund the Eugenics Record Office. The founding director of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, William Welch, sat on the ERO's board and helped direct its activities. The Rockefellers sponsored the studies of the eugenics researchers at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes in Germany, including Ernst Rudin, who would go on to draft Nazi Germany's forced sterilization law. And, when the American Eugenics Society became embarrassed of its own name, its longtime director, Frederick Osborne, merely took over as president of the Rockefeller-founded Population Council. This dedication to the cause of public health did not escape the approving gaze of Bill Gates Sr. In a chapter of his 2009 book, Showing Up for Life, called Walking with Giants, he writes admiringly of the Rockefellers and their influence in the field. Every corner we've turned in the field of global health, we've found that the Rockefellers were already there and had been there for years. When we committed to childhood immunization, we found ourselves building on efforts the Rockefeller Foundation had helped launch and fund in the 1980s. When we became interested in fighting malaria and tuberculosis, we learned that the Rockefellers had been studying the prevention and treatment of such diseases around the globe for, in some cases, as long as 100 years. A similar dynamic held true in the case of HIV/AIDS. A lesson we learned from studying and working with the Rockefellers is that to succeed in pursuing audacious goals, you need like-minded partners with whom to collaborate. And we learned that such goals are not prizes claimed by the short-winded. The Rockefellers stay with tough problems for generations. As Gates Sr. suggests, it is by working with like-minded partners that such great achievements in the field of global health can be made. For the Gates, these like-minded partners include the Rockefellers themselves. Bill Gates Sr. got to discuss global health, agriculture, and environment with the likes of David Rockefeller Sr. and David Rockefeller Jr. at a meeting on Philanthropy in a Global Century at Rockefeller University campus in 2000. And Bill Gates, as we have seen, co-hosted a meeting on reducing the population with David Rockefeller in 2009. But the most salacious hints of a deeper agenda are not to be found in the Gates' public associations, but in the associations that they have tried to hide from the public.
Jeffrey Epstein may be dead, but this story isn't. A shocking new report from the New York Times sheds light on the connection between Microsoft founder Bill Gates and the late Jeffrey Epstein. After Gates' name came up in connection with Epstein and MIT Media Lab, Gates gave a statement to the Wall Street Journal where he insisted he did not have any business relationship or friendship with Epstein. But new reporting from the New York Times outlines numerous meetings between Gates and Epstein and a conversation with Bill and Melinda Gates' foundation, a connection between their foundation and J.P. Morgan to set up a charitable fund that would financially benefit Epstein. You know what I want to know? Why?
Beginning in August of last year, a string of information connecting Bill Gates to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein began to emerge. Flight logs revealed that Gates had flown on Jeffrey Epstein's private jet. An email surfaced showing disgraced MIT Media Lab director Joy Ito, who resigned from his position after it was discovered that he had helped cover up Jeffrey Epstein's identity as an anonymous donor to the lab, informing his staff that a $2 million donation to the lab in 2014 was a gift from Bill Gates, directed by Jeffrey Epstein. As the story gained momentum, Gates tried to downplay the relationship, with a Gates spokesperson protesting that Gates didn't know it was Epstein's plane, and Gates himself insisting that, "I didn't have any business relationship or friendship with Epstein." This was immediately contradicted by the New York Times, who reported in October of 2012 that Gates had in fact met with Epstein on multiple occasions, even going so far as to discuss the creation of a multi-billion-dollar charitable fund with seed money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and J.P. Morgan Chase. According to the Times, Gates emailed his colleagues about Epstein in 2011. "His lifestyle is very different and kind of intriguing, although it would not work for me." Epstein's will even named Boris Nikolich, a Harvard-trained immunologist who served as the chief scientific advisor to both Microsoft and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and who appears in the sole publicly known photo of Epstein and Gates' 2011 meeting at Epstein's Manhattan mansion, as the backup executor of Epstein's estate. It is not difficult to see why Gates would try to distance himself from his relationship with a child sex trafficker. Epstein, after all, is suspected of ensnaring high-ranking politicians, businessmen, and even royalty in an intelligence-directed honeypot operation, recording them in the act of sexually abusing underage girls and using that evidence as blackmail. But, as it turns out, the attempt to suppress the Gates-Epstein story may have been an attempt to suppress the revelation of an altogether different shared interest.
Sources say several accusers have come forward in New Mexico, where Epstein owns a sprawling ranch. According to a new report published in the New York Times, not verified by NBC News, Epstein wanted to use the ranch for controlled breeding, using his DNA to improve humanity, citing two award-winning scientists and an advisor to large...
Okay. You can finish watching this at PRN.fm. Tomorrow, we're taking on Google, Twitter, Facebook, and Wikipedia. No small adversaries, but we believe the truth on our side, the people's side, will in the end prevail. We'll begin our efforts tomorrow. We'll lay it all out for you, and you can have an opportunity to participate. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.